Hey, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about caches. So Samir has gone over sort of our basic structure of our set associative caches, where we have a tag store, which stores metadata, including whether something we're looking for is in the cache. And in a set associative cache, we take part of the address and use that to say where in the cache we're looking. We have these sets, like this one highlighted in red here. And that's a part of the tag store, and a part of the data store belongs to the set. And the tag store tells us, well, of the things in the set, which of them are in the cache? We know that because we have these tag bits, which are the part of the address we didn't use to figure out what set we're in, and we're not going to use later on to figure out where in the block that might be stored in the data store we're looking. Yes?
So for the bits that we're using to identify the tag and the index and the address, are those values that we're assigning the address, or just we're just reading whatever bits are there?
The bits that are you, which
the... So like the 110, like that, those like 8 or 7 bits.
So on this picture, this is an address, and the cache gets an address. So the caches that we're talking about are exactly what that mysterious data memory box and instruction memory box that you have in your HCL2D processors are. That's exactly what these are, and that's where that address is coming from. So it's the address input to a data or instruction memory, and the data or instruction memory is actually a cache. So it's whatever the program is using is what the address we get, and how the address is split up is decided based on what's in our cache. So in this cache, each of the parts of the data store, we have 2 ways in the cache, and we have 2 bytes for each of those ways in each set. So each block has 2 bytes, which means we need 1 bit in our address to tell which of those bytes were the processor is asking the cache for. So that's why we have 1 bit here going to this mux, because there's 2 possibilities for the byte we're asking for. We have, in this case, 3 bits to ask for the set index, because there are 8 sets. And we need 3 bits to identify all of them. And we want to use as much as we can from the address to figure out what set, because we want to spread things out. And everything that's left over needs to be the tag. When we look something up in this tag store, we need to know that, yes, we actually have the thing that was at that address in memory. So we need everything we didn't use before, because we don't want it to be the case that there's any other address which could have this B4, B5 value that was went in our cache. So we need all the other bits of the address to check that, yes, the thing you were looking for there, that's actually the address whose value is stored there. And in addition, we might need some other bits that I'm not showing here. Like if we're implementing a write-back policy, we need a dirty bit. Because at some point when we do replacement in this cache, then we would need to know, OK, I need to write that back to memory, because it's something memory needs, versus, oh, I probably don't need to write that back to memory. I just read it. It's not the different than memory. And if we're implementing an LRU policy, we'd also need some extra data here to say which of these blocks is most recently used or least recently used. This is sort of the minimum bare bones that we would have in our set associative caches. So any questions on this sort of picture here? Yeah.
When you check the tag, what is 00 referring to? Like, you know, you have 1, 1, and 0, 1 listed. Like, what would 00
mean? So what would the question is, what is a tag of 00? So in this case, we have a tag of 00 here, okay, for example. So what that means is that these bytes AA and BB are at the address which has 00 in the tag bits, followed by whatever the index of the set is, which is presumably all zeros.
Right.
And that means that offset 0 in that block is AA.
Right.
That means that, therefore, an address 00000 is AA, and that's stored in this cache. And that's what this tag is telling us.
I mean, like, so in this case, you have the index bit is 100, which is 4, so index 4.
Yeah.
What would a tag of 00 be referring to in this case? Because right now...
In here, what would it mean if this tag was 00, for example?
Yeah, for example.
So in that case, that means that, that would mean that 44 was at address 00100.
Oh, so I guess what I mean is, like, could there ever be a situation when you have 00011011 with the same index?
Where you have, what do you mean, where you have?
So what I mean is, like, right
I,
now
I can't this, keep track of all those numbers in my head.
So right now you have this current state in index 4, right, the red circle.
Yeah.
When you wanted to add something with the same index bit, but with 00 as the tag, would you have to kick off one of these?
So the question is, let's say I get an access to the same address, but with 00, let's say.
Yeah.
Would I need to kick out one of these? Absolutely. And that was the replacement policies, like least recently used, that Samira talked about. That would be how we decide what we kick out. So we either need to kick something out, or we need to decide not to store the thing we just accessed.
Would you also need to determine using the policy in which of the left or right, like the first or second way you're putting it in?
Yes, and the question is, would we need to determine using the policy where we store it, whether we replace this B4B5 or this 3344? Yes, that would be something the policy would tell us how to determine. So with a least recently used policy, we'd have an extra bit of information, probably in our tag store, saying which of the two blocks is most recently used. And we'd use that to determine which one to replace. If we had a random policy, we wouldn't have any extra information, and we just make a random choice, which in hardware means you have a random number generator circuit somewhere. Okay. Other questions on this operation? Okay, so one thing our book goes over a lot is how we know, like, how the relationship between this address and this lookup. And this is an important thing to understand if you want to reason about what is my cache doing with my program. People, you want to know, you know, I know I'm accessing memory in this particular way. How is that going to actually map to my caches? And our book expresses this in terms of a bunch of formulas. And this is one way you can think about it. If you want to just memorize a bunch of formulas, that is fine with me. But you should be able to derive all of these. So for example, the book says the number of set index bits is related to the number of sets in this way. That's just saying if I have 2 bits, I have 2 to the 2 things I can be referencing. If I have 3 bits, I have 2 to the 3 things you can be referencing. So you could reason that out yourself. You say if there's 16 possible indices, I need 4 bits to tell which one I'm using. And that's how you tell how many bits from the address we're going to use to determine what set to go to. Similarly, if I have 4 bytes in a block, I need 2 bits to determine which byte in a block I'm referring to. That's how we determine how many bits in the address are telling us what part of a block that we got from the cache we need to look at. And everything left over is the tag bits, which is just our logic that when we access something from the cache, we know based on where we got it in the cache what the index bits are, because we know what set we got it from, and what the block offset bits are, because we know where in the block we got it. But everything else we don't know needs to be part of the tag, so we can check that we, in fact, got the address we wanted to get. And our cache size is simply the size of a block times the size of a set, times the number of sets times the number of ways we have in each set. So that's something you could reason about with from our picture. Okay. So questions on these formulas? I think you could figure these out if you needed? Yeah.
Could you walk through the tag bit?
So the question is about the tag bit formula. So with the tag bits, so the tag is what we use here. Let's say we got B5 here. So we know because we got it from this row that the index bits of wherever that is must be 100, because this is the row which has those index bits. It's row number 4. So So the address must have those index bits. And we know it's the, let's say, second byte in a block. So we know that the block offset bits must be 1. So the question is, what's the rest of the address? And the tag needs to exactly answer that question. So that's why the tag here is the number of set index bits, so the number of bits we use to get that part of the address, plus the number of block offset bits, the number of bits we use to determine where in the block we are. So it's that stuff added together. That's the stuff we know based on where we're looking in the cache about the address that we must have looked up. Everything else needs to be part of the tag. So this M is the size of an address. So on YD6, 64, that's 64 bits. So everything else there needs to be in the tag so we can confirm we got the right address. And there's never going to be a case where we store address A in the cache, look up address B, and think we found it, even though we actually got the value for address A. Other questions on these formulas? Okay, so given that, I have an exercise here. So my desktop has these caches. I have an L1 data cache, which is 32 kilobytes. That's a power of 2 kilobytes, not power of 10 kilobytes, with 8 blocks per set, so it's 8-way, and 64 byte blocks. It has a second level cache, which is 256 kilobytes with 4 blocks per set, so 4-way, and a third level cache with 8 megabytes that has 16 ways. And I want you to tell me, here's an address, how does it divide up into tag, index, and offset? And you probably want some paper or something. So a good first step here is to first figure out how many block offset bits there are, and then how many set index bits there are. And you're welcome to talk to people if you think that helps you.
Is it just because the index and the like the byte block were like 3 and 1 spec or whatever?
It's because of how big the address was, minus those, yes.
So why wouldn't you just send like one of those bits to the index?
Because then you need more sets.
Kilobyte is 1024 bytes.
If you want to send another bit to the index, you need to add a set. You need to add twice, double the number of sets, right? Because each index set needs to have its own unique index.
Right. So then, wouldn't you have more space?
It's like the then you need to make your cache bigger, which is not something you can do.
I'm trying to go back to the diagram. Blocks.
So, questions? So, okay. So, a question. You're wondering 32. You think
32 kilobytes divided by 64 bytes is 500.
So you're thinking you're getting 500. Sorry, these are powers of 2 kilobytes. So, 2 to the 10 bytes, not 10 to the 3. Because as you observe, you can't really have a cache with half a block or something like that. So I guess the trickiest part for most people with this is that we're starting with the cache size, which is usually what you're told. Like if you, like this is basically the information Intel's gonna give you about your processor. And you need to get to this. So a good first step you want to probably extract this big S from that formula first. It's probably a good first step. Which is the number of sets. So who thinks they have any part of the answer? Part of the answer. So I'll give the starting point. The first thing you probably should do is figure out how many block offset bits there are. So we tell you right away that there are 64-byte blocks. And we have this formula, which is just the logic that if you have 64 bytes, how many bits do I need to know which of those one of 64 bytes I'm referring to? So remember our powers of two. This, by the way, is the biggest reason why we talked about powers of two earlier in the semester. We get six. So there are six bits we need to say which of the 64 bytes in a block we're referring to. And that's actually the same for all of these, because they all use the same block size, which is not a coincidence, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that Intel decided that probably would make things more convenient for them. Okay. And from that, our next step is probably going to be to use this formula. And we have the number of blocks per set, which is 8, the number of ways. So this is for the L1 cache. Question?
So we have the B and S are both bytes, so I guess 32 kilobytes is 2 to
20.
It's not a kilo, 2 to the 20.
That's meg.
Oh, that's meg?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's 50.
Why are they the same?
Yeah.
If they're both, they're
B and the same.
Wait.
Yeah.
Is that the other one?
Press read.
Yeah.
Am I going back to the previous slide?
Sure.
So S was an index address. So it's 6, right? Which means the offset is the last. Right. So the offset is 1, 0, 1, 1. Go. Offset is last, right?
Okay.
Then there would not be a set.
Okay, does anyone have the division, at least have any part of the answer for the L1 that they could share?
Maybe.
Maybe.
2 seconds.
Okay, over there? Yeah, sure.
Sure. So I think what it's going to end up being is so you have the 32 kilobytes.
Okay.
So 32 kilobytes divided by 64 times 8, the number of blocks per set times.
Yeah, which I think is that.
Yeah. So that's equal to 62.5, but I'm pretty sure you have to round up to the nearest power of 2.
So 32 kilobytes is meant to be a power of 2, which is probably what you did wrong. Yeah, so you just make sure you choose the power of 2 that's close to 32 kilobytes, which is 2 to the 15th. And you get what number of sets? 2 to the 6. So if you do this calculation, just filling in the blanks from up above, you get that there are 2 to the 6 sets. Which means that there are, which is 64, which means that there are 6 index bits for the set. So now we know that there are 6 block offset bits and 6 index bits, and you could compute the number of tag bits, but why bother? Because you have the address, you just know that anything you don't put in the index and block is part of the tag. Yeah?
How do you solve the set index bits without the cache equation?
How do you solve the set index bits with, I mean, what do you mean? You don't want to use this formula?
Yeah.
So the annoyance is, you know, is it you're worried about not memorizing this formula?
No, I'm just worried about, like, what does that mean?
So like, you should be able to figure out this formula. This formula is saying is saying, so if we have some number of sets times one way of thinking about it is that when we have a set, we have some number of ways. The number of ways is E in the formula. And each way has one block of data. And that takes up B bytes. So E times B is the amount of data we have stored per set. We multiply times the number of sets, and that's the size that people tell us when they quote a cache size. So, yeah. So you shouldn't need to memorize this formula. I don't care if you do, but you should be able to figure this out from knowing what it means for the cache size to be that. The only tricky thing that confuses some people is that when processor manufacturers talk about cache sizes, they're talking about the amount of data stored. So so on our original example here, this is the cache size, this blue part. They don't talk about any of the green part when they're telling you what the size of the cache is.
For the sake of the problem we just did, we are considering the...
We're only talking... When the cache sizes in the problem are this size.
Okay.
So they don't include any of this stuff, even though it's there.
Okay.
And that's typically what people are going to say when they talk about cache sizes. Okay, so we have that division. So we know that there's 6 offset bits and 6 index bits. And everything else is in the tag. And you can do this again for each of the other caches. And assuming I updated these slides correctly, these are the numbers. I hope I updated them when I needed to. I previously had a different machine. At least this number is correct. But you do the same calculation. It's exactly the same as it is for the L1. You just repeat it for each of these other cache parameters. Yeah.
When you say the rest, like, what is the total? Like, how do we get the total?
So the question is, how do we know the total, this M, the number of memory address bits?
Yeah.
So that's the size of our address. And as far as we know so far, that's the total number of bits in an address, which is 64 bits on a 64-bit x86 system, 32 bits in a 32-bit x86 system. We will learn later in the semester that that's not actually true, that there are actually less bits there. But for now, as far as we know, it's just the size of an address that you present to the memory.
So it's 52 for this first?
Yes. So it seems like it should be 52. To get the short version, what actually happens on modern processors typically that are 64-bit is that they don't use all of the address bits, and they just require some of them have the same value as the highest bit. To avoid that, just because they don't want to like store 50 bits in their caches for the tag. Given that you're never going to have a system with 2 to the 60 bytes of memory. But you know, from our model, like what you're doing in HCL2D, you're passing a 64-bit address, so that looks like what you're getting. So once you have the division into the number of bits, you take the address, you write it out as binary, and you just split out the bits. So these bottom 6 bits are the offset. It's always the bottom bits, because we store adjacent addresses together in a block. We could have chosen not to do that, but that would be really confusing. And also bad for spatial locality, because remember, blocks keep things that are together in memory together in the cache. And the next thing is the index bits. And the index bits are the next 6 bits, since there's 6 of them, and they're not overlapping with the offset because we, you know, the offset is entirely within the block. And we could have used some other bits for the index bits, but that's going to be bad for making sure our cache can contain, if we have accessing things close to each other, that we can store all of them in our cache at the same time. So you could make a cache where your index bits were up here instead of over here and the rest was tag, but that doesn't make sense and no one does that because it's just bad, because it doesn't let us store a contiguous array in the cache. So we don't do that. So always it's tag bits, then index bits, then block offset bits, in that order. And everything left over is the tag, yes?
At a very high level, just to review, the point of separating the trade-offs between having more tag bits versus more index bits, having more tag bits allows you to have less comparisons, right?
So the question is, why would we want to have more tag bits and less index bits? So it is true that there is something about these comparators having a cost, but this is not the primary concern. Our primary concern in most cache design decisions is going to be, how does it affect our hit rate? Most cache design decisions where we don't make the cache much bigger or much smaller.
Yeah.
So adding a tag bit, yes, it makes things a little bigger, perhaps, but it doesn't do it by much. We're adding one bit for every 16 bits of data, 32 bits of, 16 bits of data, every block here. That's not that much overhead. So our main concern is gonna be, how is this gonna affect the hit rate? And if we add a tag bit stealing from the index bits, what that means is we're doubling the number of ways if we're keeping the cache size the same. And the additional choices about where we keep data, that means avoiding conflict misses. That if we have 2 things we're accessing or 10 things we're accessing which have the same index bits, we'll have less problems with not being able to fit all of them in the cache when we increase the associativity. So that's where the main benefit is going to be, and that's what the main concern is going to be, is how much does the hit rate change?
Okay.
Because that's going to probably hide any difference in the comparator performance. Realistic numbers for a good hit rate for an L1 cache on typical programs, you can write a program with a 0% hit rate, and those exist in real life. People sometimes write programs which randomly access things which have almost a 0% hit rate. But generally, for a typical program, the sort of hit rate a processor manufacturer expects is something 95 to 97 to 98 or 99%. And the difference between 98% and 99% hit rate as far as performance goes is huge. And it's because the next level of cache is often 2 to 10 times slower. So going from being 2 to 10 times slower 1% of the time to 2% of the time is a huge difference.
And the way that we increase,
you're saying.
We increase the hit rate by increasing associativity, or?
So the question is, do we increase the hit rate by increasing associativity? So usually, increasing associativity will increase the hit rate. If you already have a pretty high associativity, usually not by much.
Okay.
So there's, as Samira said last time, there's diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And this is true for a lot of other decisions we make in designing our cache. Usually, doubling the size of the cache will increase the hit rate.
Yeah.
But at some point, it won't do it by much.
Yeah.
And that's true for other decisions we might make. Yes? So the question is, what do I mean by increasing associativity? That means adding columns to this to the adding additional columns of data with a corresponding additional valid and tag columns.
So if you were to like cut those off,
yes. So the example here, yes, would be I could like divide this in half, take the bottom half and like put it on the side.
Would that really make it
faster? It would. So the question is, would that really make it faster? So it makes accesses slightly slower because we have, it makes the hit time slightly slower when we do that because we have more comparators. But hopefully, but not necessarily, it increases the hit rate, which means it decreases the amount of time we're waiting on a cache miss. So it's going to make normal accesses slower at the cost of making the abnormal case of misses less likely, hopefully. Not necessarily, but hopefully. So that's the trade-off. So there's a point where that diminishing returns means that maybe that extra little cost of the extra comparators and all that becomes significant. And it definitely happens eventually. Like in our L1 cache here, if we went from 8-way associativity to 64-way, that probably would not be worth it, because that's a whole lot of extra comparators and muxes. But going from 8 to 16 might be more of a wash. Like, we probably get a little increase in hit rate and therefore less misses and less time waiting for misses with a very slight increase in hit time, and that might be worth it, it might not. Presumably, it's probably not worth it because the Intel designers chose this.
Finally, this is my last question before I'll let you move on, but when you say, so just to make clear, when you increase associativity, you are increasing the tag bits, right?
So the question is, when we increase associativity, we are increasing the tag bits. If we don't change the size of the cache, this is true. And you can reason about it with these formulas. You can say, if we're increasing E and not changing anything out and not changing the cache size, that means S has to decrease if we aren't also changing the block size. Yeah.
Clarify. So if you're adding, for the previous slide, if you're like adding another column, that you have to add an associated tag bit. And
yeah, so each of these data columns needs a corresponding valid and tag column.
So that this is two blocks in a set, right?
Yeah, so this cache here is two blocks in a set, okay. And if we added another valid and tag column and another data column, it would be three blocks in a set.
And that would be more associative.
Yes. Okay. So we know how to split addresses up, and with that, I will go on to looking at the example Samira ended with last time, which is our matrix squaring loop. So here we're accumulating a value in B, which is the square of the matrix A, if you remember your linear algebra, and I didn't screw up the formula. And we have these two loop orders, and they have different locality, if you remember. That we have cases where we have good temporal locality in both of these loops. In this case, we have good temporal locality in this because K doesn't change between iterations of the loop, so of the innermost loop. So every iteration of that innermost loop, we're accessing the same thing. So we have good temporal locality there. Here, J doesn't change in iterations of the innermost loop, so we have good temporal locality in this value. And we also see that we have some differences in spatial locality. So we have good spatial locality in this value here, this AI times N plus K, because K is going forward by 1, so those are adjacent values in memory. And similarly, we have good locality in this value here, where J is going forward by 1, because those are adjacent values in memory. And how is our cache going to take advantage of that locality, that spatial locality?
Like loading the elements that are coming forward. So like we load the entire page, and then it has all the elements in cache that are directly after
So it's loading all the elements together. So we load the entire block. Page is something different, we will talk about later. So we load the entire block. So when we load a block for this ak times n plus j, we'll probably have ak times n plus j plus 1 is also in that block. So that has good spatial locality, and because they're together in a block, our cache is going to be able to take advantage of that.
Would the first part also have good spatial locality, bi times n plus j?
So does this have good spatial locality is the question, and yes, it does. So these loops, they have different sorts of spatial and temporal locality, and as we talked about last time, you could try to reason about what their performance is based on that, but obviously in practice what you're going to do is you're just going to run them and time them. So these are the results I have for sort of raw results. So they have the same number of instructions. And this is a key thing about sort of cache optimizations. It's not about counting instructions like you're kind of used to saying, this program is faster, it does less. These have the same number of instructions, and that makes sense. So this program executes the same number of instructions, the two versions, these lines exactly overlap, that's why you can't see the blue line, for every size. But they take very different numbers of cycles. This is on my desktop. Just by swapping the loop order, and that's because the locality in one case was better than the other. It wasn't because there was no locality in one case and some locality in the other, it's because they had different amounts of locality, and it ended up making a big difference. You might also notice that there are spikes here. Those are not measurement errors. Any guesses as to why there would be a spike right here? Just by the way, is the point for 512. Yeah?
Is that why it like needs to, like when there's a miss and it has to repeat?
So the question is that when there's a miss and it has to get something? So there are more misses in this case. But this is saying, it's the same program just with n equals 512 is much slower than with n equals 511. Yeah?
Is it because we reached the max size of our cache and we have to purge everything and put the new stuff in?
So the question is it because we released the max size of our cache? So that would be a possibility, but if we ran out of space in our cache, that is we had a capacity miss, we would expect that the larger size, 513, would also be as slow. But it is not. So that tells us that is not what is happening. But if you only had the point 512 and 511, you might say that would be a good guess. But since we have the 513 point, which is lower, we know that is not quite what's happening. Yes?
We had to go back to memory.
So the answer is we have to go back to memory. So presumably, the difference is cache, partly because that's what we're going over, and partly because all that changed is the access pattern. So there's some reason we have to miss. So if it's not that we ran out of space in the cache, what could it be? So Samira talked about three reasons for missing in the cache.
Conflict, compulsory, and capacity.
So people remember conflict, compulsory, and capacity. So capacity miss is we ran out of space. And we know that's not happening because with something bigger, we don't run out of space, apparently. A compulsory miss is we're loading something for the first time. And that can't be the difference because we'd also be loading it for the first time at the larger size. So it must be a conflict miss. And we'll look at what that is in a sec. Okay, so another way of viewing this, and a common thing we'll do, is we'll talk about something like cycles per instruction. This is sort of an efficiency measure. And usually the reason why instructions take lots of cycles is because we have to talk to memory. And you can see the difference is more prominent here, and this gets rid of the sort of scaling factors from how big our problem becomes, because it's n cubed sort of thing. And we see that we have this settles down at a nice low number, and we have the spikes are even more apparent here. And you can notice a pattern in that. Another way you might view this is cycles per operation. So in this case, cycles per multiply or add, which I will use later on because we might change the amount of other stuff we're doing and we still want to know how much work are we actually getting done. Okay, so the big thing that changing this order did is it, you know, it helped us optimize our cache misses. And it turns out on a modern processor, you can look at this directly. So I, on my desktop, figured out how to get a what is called a performance counter of L1 cache misses. And I've plotted the number of cache misses per 1,000 instructions for the two different versions of the loop. So we can see directly that we have that, you know, that the numbers are actually a little more comparable than it seems like they should be, which happens. There's other things going on about when we can access things and when we're waiting. And we have lots of spikes in this inner version, the wrong loop order, the IJK order, which had slightly worse locality. And we see that we still have these spikes. So the spikes are caused because we have lots more cache misses like we'd expect. And let's take a zoomed in look at these spikes. So this is the number of read misses for 1,000 instructions. And we have these spikes here. And I do have enough measurements that I know these aren't outliers. And you might say, you know, what's with these numbers? What's funny about this number or this number or this number? And it's not obvious. So what we can, if we look at this, we can figure it out. So this number is 2 to the 7th. This number is 93, and it happens that 93 times 11 is very close to 2 to the 10th. This number, right down here, this number is 114. It happens 114 times 9 is very close to 2 to the 10th. And that's not a coincidence. And so this is where how we split up the address into tag index and offset matter. So let's think about what's going to happen when we advance an array based on these intervals. So we're going to access, like, k times 114, let's say, if n is 114, plus j. And we're accessing floats in this case, so they're 4 bytes. So the next address is we add 4. So we get there. But if we do k plus 1, we get this pattern, which, you know, due to the math, you could do that by hand, but that would be really annoying. And when you get to k plus 9, you get this pattern here. This is the address you get when you add that. And if you remember, we found out that there were 6 block offset bits in my L1 cache on my desktop, which is the machine I ran this on, and 6 set index bits. So let's highlight the set index bits. So you can see that if we start at this address, then k plus 9 has the same set index bits quite often. And this is the sort of thing which is happening, which causes those spikes and misses. That it happens that things which are close by in our loop that we access, you know, only 9 iterations later, map to the same set. So we have conflicts. Whereas with the other sizes, they typically map to more sets, so we can use more of our cache. But here, basically, we're using it turns out we're going to mostly use basically 9 of the sets of our cache more highly than the others within a couple iterations of the loop. Yeah?
So in the last slide, if you don't mind going back, when you had 93 times 11 and 114 times 9, those 11 and 9 come from like j plus whatever or k, like however many elements forward?
So the question is, where does this 11 and 9 come from? And it's exactly that. That when we go that many iterations forward in the loop, we start getting conflicts. The exact number doesn't particularly matter, just matters that it's small enough that we're going to see that access soon, and we're not going to be able to use all the sets of our cache. So we'd like it to be the case that each of these accesses all map to different sets, so we can store as much of, you know, these AKJ stuff in our cache. Yes.
So, sort of, maybe just taking a step back, slightly using the forest and the trees kind of concept. So, I see how this is causing a slowdown, but what can we as programmers do to resolve this other than calculating out exactly all the addresses that are going to be?
So the question is, what can you do as programmers to fix this? So we might talk about that a bit later. I mean, one thing, and we'll talk a bit about something which incidentally helps with it. I don't think we'll talk about the exact solution to this, but this is a reason why having good spatial locality will help you. Because if you have better spatial locality, you're not going to have these big skips. So that's one basic thing you can do, is try to have the loop orders where you have the better spatial locality and not skipping around in the array, knowing that skipping around will tend to do things like this. There are other solutions you can do to this, which we may or may not talk about later in the semester, probably after the exam, if we do. The basic idea is that it's actually often faster to copy a part of the array to some other place to avoid this problem, which makes no sense because we're doing extra memory accesses to speed up our memory, but turns out to be better. Okay. So this is what those spikes are from. So those are conflict misses. Okay. So we're going to talk about speeding up this loop more. So this loop is actually not so efficient, even though this is the right order, which avoided most of the conflict misses because it has better spatial locality. It still could do better. Yeah.
Question for the conflict misses. So how does it work if you have like? So when do you have to like? So say you have something with the same memory address and same tag bit. Same memory address. Why would you have to overwrite something else, in the memory address?
So the question is, when we had these conflicts, why did we have to overwrite one of the old values? So our cache is going to implement some policy to try to keep recently used values, but if our recently used values tend to be all mapped to the same set, we have to fit more. We want to try to fit more values in the same set. So the issue is not that our policy for replacement is necessarily bad. It's that we have more stuff going to each of the sets we're using. So what's going to happen if you actually looked at these set index bits through the whole pattern, you'd find that there were less sets in use than we should be using.
The tag bits are telling you what block, right?
Tag bits tell you tag bits tell you, I found a bunch of possible blocks in the set. Which one is it?
So you can have different. You have more possible tag bits than blocks in the set, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. Because your cache can store. Because you can't possibly store the entire all of memory in this cache. So there's always more things to put in a set than you could possibly fit there.
So if we do it the other way, we're utilizing more of the rows in the cache, but if we do it this way, we're hitting every single like column, but we're not hitting all the rows?
Yeah, so there's two problems which are making this slower. So one problem is we're not using every single set in the cache, most likely, just because we repeat a set after 9 iterations, where if we had a better offset, we'd probably repeat it after, if we had 64 sets in the cache, around 64 iterations. That would be the ideal, right? We use all the sets evenly. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that because we're skipping by this much, we also don't get to use something else in the same block very often, just because we have normal bad spatial locality. So that's also inefficient. So I'm going to look at speeding up our optimized or our correct loop order by looking at this more systematically. So we're going to want to get the most out of each cache miss. That's the way you should think about writing your code to take advantage of caches, is that you want to do as much work as possible each time a cache miss has to happen. And you know you have to do cache misses because at least you have those compulsory misses. The first time you access something has to miss. And with something like this, if n is big, you probably have more. There's not any way you can think about doing this where you load something and do all the computations with it. Because, for example, when I access bi times n plus j, I need to access a whole lot of stuff from a to do computations with that, which I'm not going to be able to keep all of that in cache if n is big. There's no way. So I have to make some compromise. In this case, we've made an interesting little compromise. Every time we have a miss to load aik, every time we load this ai times n plus k, we manage to use it n times. Every time we load bi times n plus j, if n is large enough, we don't get to reuse it until we don't get to use it until the next iteration of the k loop. So if n is big enough, we load it to do this plus equals, and then we don't get to use it again until it's already out of the cache. Does that make sense? That sort of idea that as long as all this stuff from A is big enough, there's no way that the next time we access bi times n plus j, it's going to be in the cache again. This is just temporal locality. And similarly, for ai times a k times n plus j, the next time we access that exact part of A for this part of the computation, assuming that there's a lot of stuff, that n is big enough, that we're going to load enough stuff for this ai times n plus k and this bi times n plus j, and so on, there's no way it's going to be in the cache again. If n is big enough, we're going to have enough stuff we're loading for this and for this that we're going to have to evict it, that we're going to load, like, if n is 10,000, we're going to load 10,000 floats before and use them before we use this ak times n plus j again. So if n is big, we're doing n computations for each aik and one computation for everything else every time we load it. So if n is like 10,000, and let's say 10,000 things don't fit in our cache. So effectively, we're using our cache to cache, when n is big, we're using our cache to cache one thing, which doesn't seem very efficient. So we'd like to do better than that. And another way of looking at this is that, we're accessing part of A, two parts of A and a part of B, and we're iterating over the J's. So we're accessing this row of A and B, but we access that once, and then we're done iterating. So we have spatial locality here, but no temporal locality, really, assuming N is big enough. And also, we don't actually have that great spatial locality in AIK. We load this one element of AIK, which means we load the whole cache block that contains it, and use that one element. We're not making very good use of our cache. And here, maybe we could keep this whole row cached since we use it again, but that's about as good as we can do. Only if we can cache the whole thing, those cache blocks might stay loaded. If this is too wide to fit in our cache, we're out of luck. And here, we get some spatial locality, but we need to be able, if we want to have this be used the next time we go through B, that needs to be the case that we keep all of A in the cache too, which seems unlikely if N is any reasonable size. So does this sort of division make sense here? How we're not making great use of our cache here? And one way I like reasoning about what's happening here is that you can just pretend you're explicitly managing the cache. So we can say, I'm going to load AIK here. That's effectively what my code does. I'm not actually doing that in my real code, but I can think of it saying, I'm loading AIK here, and I'm loading BIK and BKJ here. I can think of saying, my code loads something here, loads something here for this part of the code, and then gets rid of it. And this is good for reasoning about it because you can think of how much of the cache am I using by doing this. So when I look at this, I find out I'm using the cache for that AIK value, and that seems to be about it. So we're going to have a transformation where we can say, instead of I'm using AIK over and over again, so it's going to be loaded in cache for a loop, I'm going to say, I'm going to have more values in cache for a loop that I'm going to keep reusing. And I'm going to do this simple transformation, which I'm going to try to show you I'm not changing what the code does. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to split the loop over k into two loops. So I haven't changed anything about how this code works or how it accesses memory yet. So I just loop over k with, you know, with 0, 2, 4, 6, and I add 1 to it, and so on. Okay, this makes sense? Okay, and now I'm going to do the same thing I started out with. I started out by changing the order of my loops. I'm going to do the same thing here. And I'm going to move this loop that I split into the middle. So I moved it from up here, where I split the K loop into two parts. I just reordered the loop, so I'm iterating over the exact same things, just in a different order. It's the same thing I started with, where I swapped the K loop from the beginning to the bottom. I'm doing the same transformation, but with my now split up loop. So I took this code up from here and just moved it down here. The values of k, I, and j are all the same, and it doesn't matter what order we do these plus equal statements in, assuming arithmetic is actually, you know, associative and commutative, which it isn't, but we'll ignore that. So any questions about this transformation? People look confused. Yeah.
So what is this KK doing?
It's just to let this loop here choose the right initial value and second value. I want to have this outer loop go by 2 and use wherever that is to choose two values of k. You still look confused, so. This is just a way of iterating k from 0 to n, where I just have two loops instead of one. So the kk is 0, and then I set k to 0, k to 1, then kk is 2, I set k to 2, k to 3, and so on. So I've just divided the loop from k from 0 to n into two loops.
So has it affected the performance at all?
Here it slowed it down because I added extra stuff, in fact. But the reason I did it is so I can move this loop over two values of k to the middle. So now I'm accessing in a different order. I'm accessing A0, 0, 0, A0, 1, then and in that order, where I wouldn't do that before.
Before you did the same value of k, but you iterated through high values before you changed the k value, right?
Before I would have to go through all the possible values of I and j before I got to the next k. Here I'm going to go to the next k once, go to one of the next k's with the same I and j, but not all of them. And the basic idea you should be thinking of is that when we looked at our analysis, we were making maximum use of AIK and not great use of everything else. And we're going to try to make a compromise instead. So we're not going to get quite as good temporal locality in anything, but we're going to get better temporal locality in other things. So let's look at expanding this innermost loop. So this is what it looks like expanded. So I just expanded out the loop exactly. And you can see that we have some extra sources of locality here. So one thing that this new loop order does is that now we're accessing Bij twice. Whereas previously, we basically had no temporal locality in Bij. because we wouldn't access it until the next iteration of the outermost loop. So now we have some temporal locality in Vij. We have more spatial locality in the AIKs. Question?
So the idea here is that, like, right now we're doing two of them, but we're, like, working towards finding some kind of sweet spot where maybe we end up doing, like, eight or nine, some number of these.
Yeah, so we're trying to get, yeah, so we're getting more locality in other things. And we're working on getting basically, yeah, a sweet spot, you could say, of locality in everything we're accessing. It's going to be the goal. Yeah.
Why was it again that we can't just have K on the inside?
So if we have K on the inside, then we would have good locality in Bij, but we make our locality in Aik worse. We make our spatial locality better, but our temporal locality worse. So we're getting a compromise here. So here we have more spatial locality in that, but for example, we still have good spatial and temporal locality in this. If we moved K to the inside, this would have horrible spatial locality. But now at least, between iterations of this innermost loop, we access adjacent things still. Whereas if we just move the K loop to this middle, this would be accessing completely different things every time. So you have this sort of compromise where we got better locality in these first two things without making the locality in this last AKJ really, really bad, which is what we would have to do before. So yes, these two things are very far apart in memory, but that's only two things, it's not like 10. And between iterations of the innermost loop with this expansion, we're accessing still adjacent things, so we still have spatial locality. And so this is a general improvement in our locality. And when you do this adjustment, it's going to improve your cache misses. So here's what it does, doing that transformation, splitting up the K loop and moving the two iteration part of the loop to the center. Here's what it does to the number of cache misses. So we basically half the number of cache misses. And that's because we have all that extra temporal and spatial locality. Performance doesn't actually improve, but we'll get to that some much later class. But it will eventually improve when we do this right. Yes?
But so without splitting the K, what would be like the best order for the loops?
The best order. So my question is, what's the best order for the loops without splitting the K? It was the Kij order.
Kij.
The one we started with.
So if you have a three-dimensional array, Ijk.
It depends on what operations you're doing in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
It also, this is with square arrays. The answer might be different with non-square arrays. And this is with my desktop. The answer might be different with a different cache. Like block sizes could affect it. There's other things that caches do that we may or may not talk about this semester that can affect it. So it's not straightforward to say, I figured out what was the best order by testing them. So we did this transformation for K, where we got a little extra locality in a bunch of things in exchange for slightly making the locality worse in some things that the locality was good in. And you might say, well, can we do that more? Why did we just do it with K? Could we do it with the other things? And you absolutely can. And you absolutely get more of an improvement by doing this. So we have more temporal locality in our inner loop too, and more, you know, because we like reuse this AKJ, which we weren't doing before. We get two more calculations out of each time we need to bring it into the cache. So we have even better locality. And so this idea is called cache blocking. And the name comes because we have this sort of block of the data structure we're accessing. And the idea is that we're going to bring in this whole block into the cache, and we're going to do all the work we can on that. and we're going to bring the corresponding blocks of everything else we're accessing. So we access this block of A and the corresponding parts for the other terms in our calculation. So now we have more spatial locality. So previously we were bringing in a whole cache block for an element of AIK and accessing one thing. Now we're accessing two things in it. We're bringing in two cache blocks because we have expanded both loops, but we're accessing two things from each of them. So we're still getting better efficiency. You know, so every time we have to bring a block into the cache, we're doing a whole lot more calculations with it. And you know, and we're also getting more work out of these accesses that we aren't caching so well when we're iterating through A and B here, A and B outside of the what the innermost loop covers best, outside of the things that don't vary with the J loop. So we just generally have better locality, and you know, we just chose two. Why did we choose two? Because that was the easiest number. So what's the best number to choose?
The ways that you have.
So the question is, so one proposal is that, you know, maybe instead of choosing, so instead of choosing two, we could have chosen a size of, you know, the number of ways we have. That's a possibility, because you think that's the number of things that we could fit simultaneously. That's sort of the right idea. So what we're going to do when we don't choose two and keep doing this is that we're basically saying, I'm going to, in this innermost, you know, set of loops here, I'm going to have a block of A and B, or two blocks of A and a block of B. I'm going to hope that those stay in the cache for this entire loop. That's sort of the intuition, is that we want to have a block of this block of stuff that stays in the cache, and we want it to be as useful as possible. We want to make the best use of the cache. We want to do as many computations for the work we're doing of pulling in a block to the cache. So one way you can think about this is we're planning what's in our cache. So we talked about automatic management of caches, like how that was much more convenient and made writing programs easier. But when we're doing high performance programming, what we're gonna do is we're gonna plan what's in our cache. So even though the processor doesn't have a bring this value into cache instruction, as far generally, we're going to still do that planning by accessing things in an order where we know what's in the cache and we know it's as much as possible. And the way we're going to plan what's in the cache is we're going to choose an K, I, and J where we know this is that there's a block of I of some size, a block of K of some size. We know the sort of red parts, how big those are, you know, of the thing we're doing the calculation on. And we're going to try to make that use a good portion of the cache. Yeah. So the and when we do this optimization, you know, we get to keep using, you know, depending on our value of k, we keep reusing bij, we use aik a bunch of times based on the numbers we chose. So we want the numbers to be as big as possible. Because the bigger we make K, the bigger we make J, big J, the bigger we make big K, the more stuff we have in this inner loop, the more reuse we get, provided that everything, that we can actually keep this block cached. So if K, I, and J are too big, we'll run out of space in our cache. You know, we just end up with the loop we started with. But if we keep them small enough that everything still fits in cache in these inner loops, but big enough that we actually get reuse, a lot of reuse, will get the best performance. So we have like this sort of, we want to just plan to have these blocks of our arrays that we keep in that fit in the cache, that we're going to do all the calculations we can on when we pay the cost of accessing them once. And the idea is that we're going to keep these in cache over those entire calculations, so we'll have one cache miss for each of these elements. So that's the time I have for today. I'll just end with the real benefit of this, which is, yes, it helps. Mostly at bigger sizes.
Did you post